Hello, everybody. Please excuse this emergency addendum to this episode of the Nets Pulse podcast as part of the Pulse Podcast Network, officially brought to you by Spencer Dinwiddie's triumphant return, which could not come at a better time as the Magic have just defeated the Warriors and the Heat are up by about 77 on the Houston Rockets right now. Dark days for Nets fans, or a dark day at least. Carl, the stabilizer, the wind beneath our wings, the world's biggest Dragon Ball Z fan, he's back. Give me your rapid fire, emotionally unhinged reaction.
It could not come at a better time because I, for one, am exhausted from trying to, wipe away the skid mark on the underpants of our season that Wizards game was. We need the extra firepower. I think my hypothesis kind of coming into this is that, Dinwiddie's ability to get to the glass and ability to get to the line is going to serve as a real stabilizing force, because I think while we've seen the Nets play as well as they've played all season during, the time that he was out in the Nuggets game, for instance, I think, we've seen them be a very high variance team, very reliant on the 3-point shot alone. And I think he'll bring a little bit of stability that can kind of push us over the edge in some of these closer games.
I can't wait to have him back out there. It just seems like whenever we're down in a game and Spencer's playing, it doesn't feel like we're out of it. And if we're up and the other team starts making a comeback, he's going to be the one to make a bucket, get to the hole, get fouled, hit a big three, make a good pass. That's going to shift the momentum back in our favor. He makes very heady plays. He rarely turns the ball over. I remember when he was first getting recognition, I think 2 years ago, the biggest thing that folks were noting was his insane assist to turnover ratio, which I don't know if it was best in the league, but it was right up there, top three in the league. So I'm very excited that he's back, but I have to give you props. Earlier in the day, we were texting. You said the Magic are going to beat the Warriors tonight, aren't they? And I thought there was no chance of that happening, even with 1.5 minutes left in that game. And then lo and behold, Aaron Gordon nails a three into DeMarcus Cousins' face. DJ Augustine blows by Steph Curry on one of the worst individual defensive effort plays I've seen in my entire lifetime. And here we are. You're a prophet.
We're just cursed by what is the dragon's name again? Stuff the Magic Dragon, to be scoreboard watching the Orlando Magic, of all the indignities in the world. A team with 70, and I think it's especially taunting as a Nets fan because the Magic just run out like a 12-man rotation of exclusively power forwards. I would take several of them to upgrade our forward position, which is something we'll be talking about in a little bit.
They're like our foil if this is the WWE.
I would take Gordon. I would take Jonathan Isaac, who I know has, struggled defensively, but I think could be, a great plug-and-play fit as just a long guy who's starting to show signs of shooting a three. But, yeah, I think it's the hard-charging Magic are coming for us.
Would you take Mo La Bamba? Mo the Black Bamba on our team?
I suppose, but he would be my first choice. I would take one of their 17 power forwards, or Ross, I think, before I took Mo Bamba. Although I think Mo Bamba is going to be good.
I think so too. I mean, he's already shown the ability to shoot threes, and if you can block shots and shoot threes, there's a place for you in this league.
For sure.
But anyway, getting back on topic, and I realize I'm the one that got us off topic, so that's on me. But I, Spencer coming back now. I don't know if there is a topic. It's a
hot topic.
Oh, got it. Hot topic. Just getting him back now with some games that aren't against that insane schedule starting on the 11th to maybe play himself back into shape, find some sort of rhythm before we hit that gauntlet, I think is going to be huge for us. And like you and I talked about on the last pod, I think we're going to forfeit some of these easier games, not on purpose. And we already saw that with the Wizards, but if we can get Spencer somewhat into form running into that last stretch in the season, I think that's where we're going to get some surprising wins and finally find our way to that 39 win mark that you and I both predicted.
Yeah. I mean, I think, he brings a lot to the table, both because as we talked about, he's such a steadying influence, but he's also like their prime irrational confidence guy. So, you know, he's somebody that, like the Rockets game, I think is a prime example. I went to the game, I think it was last season against LeBron and the Cavs, where it was like kind of the first game of his big coming out party that season. And he just takes some ridiculous shots and just nails them all. So it's a definitely big guy to have back. And just in the nick of time too, because I think you could make the case that Friday's game, tonight's game, I guess, depending on when we release this pod, against Charlotte is one of the three biggest games we have left on the schedule. Four, if you count both Heat games and the Pistons game. So big time to win that season series.
He's on record multiple times as saying that when he's on the floor, he truly believes that he's the best player out there. And I love that. Having somebody like that on your team is awesome, especially when they shoot a high percentage and don't turn the ball over.
Yeah, I think that was interesting in the low post where they were interviewing Joe Harris. Joe Harris was talking about how it was either Joe or Sark who's talking about how, you know, that confidence was something that kind of rubbed the Pistons and Bulls organization the wrong way. And they talked and, you know, Zach mentioned how Spencer has said, like, listen, I'll sign anywhere except for those two places because they didn't believe in me. So I think it's great. You know, I think you need it. And just excited to have him back.
Yeah, and I want him back for that Pistons game too, because
revenge game, baby. Load it up.
Revenge is a strong drug.
Load up the revenge cannon. It's a hell of a drug.
Shall we get to our next segment?
Yes.
Awesome. Well, you go ahead, Carl. Sorry.
Yeah, so I was going to say we're going to debut, I think, a new segment here that we're going to call Jump Balls, where we find some piece of basketball minutia that the two of us find interesting, and we pretty much just have a duel to death about it with words. Brett, would you like to introduce our first topic?
No, good Lord, I would. And I need to bring everybody some of the background as to how we ended up coming up with this. So I had a good buddy that just moved to Austin, Texas, and he ended up staying with me for about a week before he found a place. And he found out that Carl and I were doing a podcast, and we got to talk, and he really wanted to be on there. And we turned into a joke where I kept telling him he couldn't be on the podcast. And now he will never be on the podcast, because now it's just one of those things where I've got that New England stubbornness from where I grew up. But we started turning that into, oh, well, your wife can be on the podcast. She called him. We said, okay, what do you know about basketball? If you were on the podcast, what kind of questions would you ask? She said, I don't know anything about basketball. So how many lines are there on a basketball? And I didn't think anything of it at the time. I just thought it was funny. And I said, well, yeah, there are obviously three lines on a basketball. It's pretty simple to me. There's two lines that cross over each other, and there's one continuous squiggly line that never breaks. There's three lines, pretty obvious. Boom. But I said, you know, why don't I Google it? Let me see what the masses have to say. Crowdsource it, as the kids say. And that's what brought Carl and I to this heated debate.
So you say there's three, and I'm pretty sure that you're wrong, and here's why. I'm not sure what my answer is, one of two numbers. So I agree with four, because when you look at a basketball in a two-dimensional plane, you see four lines. There's, you know, the two that essentially cross, and then the other ones, the other two on the side that end up kind of wrapping around the basketball. So I would accept four as that answer for that reason. And those four extend front to back, and they're the same on either side. But you insist that it's three. Please explain yourself.
I just don't understand how you can't see that the squiggly line is continuous. Maybe it's not just you. Maybe it's the entire world. But when they hit, so there's two lines that completely circumvent the ball. They cross, they're perpendicular to each other. The line that forms the loops comes around, and when it crosses over those perpendicular lines, that's still one line. It's not like the fact that it's hitting that line prevents it from being another line. And if that were the case, it crosses over those perpendicular lines twice. So you could with that argument, potentially make the case that there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines on a basketball, not 4.
So that's complete nonsense, and here's why. Because I was thinking about this earlier, and, you know, I've been prepping, you know, we've been talking since we started this podcast about free agency and who the Nets might target and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, so I put myself a little bit in the Kyrie headspace here for this. And here's the thing, my friend. There is no such thing as a line on a sphere. If it is the shortest distance between two points on a spherical object is an arc, not a line. None of these bisect through the core of the ball itself. So therefore, there's either 0 or 4, but not 3.
You know, Carl, what are words but just a construct of humans that are meaningless in the grand scheme of things?
I don't even know what you're talking about. All you're listening to is warm air vibrating out of a hole in my body.
I can't believe you went Kyrie existential on me. There's no way to argue that. This is like the end of Mean Girls. The limit does not exist.
Exactly. So we should probably just shut it down and get to our conversation about the Nets' 4 position. This is the last night of the buyout. And while we did see the New Orleans Pelicans dip into the foreign markets, does not appear that the Nets will. But you can hear us talk about it anyway, if just to hear me name drop the Fujian Sturgeons.
Hey, you got it right that time.
I did. I've been practicing all day. And a little bit of talk about the Nets zone defense, which I don't think it was a zone problem last night, but the Wizards were just absolutely tic-tacking through any defense, you know, Swiss cheesing their way through any defense that was thrown at them.
Hashtag zone goal.
One team zone goal.
Oh, God.
All right. Well, enjoy.
Have you been searching for the best ticket deals around? Well, look no further. With TixFlix, the price you see is the price you pay. And TixFlix just happens to have over $6 billion in ticket inventory just waiting for you. They absolutely mean it when they say every ticket, every venue, everywhere. And you can save even more with promo code PULSE in all caps to save you 5% off your total purchase. Go to TixFlix.com and click the search bar. Search events based on your geographic location. Pick the show you want, and bam, it's showtime. Sporting events, Broadway shows, concerts, and more with TixFlix.com. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for the email newsletter so you can stay up to date on the latest news and savings with TixFlix. That's TixFlix.com, TixFlix.com. Every ticket, every venue, everywhere.
Hello, everybody, and Carl, good to talk to you again. I feel like it's been forever. This is episode 4 of the Nets Pulse podcast on the Pulse Podcast Network, as Carl aptly named Attack of the Zones. We might not call it that, but since I've now said it on the air, I feel like we're really cornered into that one. I am your co-host, Brett the Man Bun Garofalo, sitting here, as always, with Carl the Talent Jackson. Carl, let the viewers know how you're doing.
Well, Brett, I just stuck my finger in a tulip that is sitting at my kitchen table, and some of the pollen has gotten into my nose, so if I erupt in a sneezing fit, just know that's why. But hey, that's why. Let's go Nets.
I was not expecting that. That's why they invented the mute button, Carl.
I guess that's true. That's true. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I guess I could do that, I suppose. So, you know, you mentioned that we are calling this podcast Attack of the Zones because we are going to be talking a lot about Kenny Atkinson's zone defense and the pros and cons of it. But before that, I wanted to talk a little bit about something that is all the buzz on the Twitters, which is the Nets power forward 4 position. And if we were in keeping with the proper Star Wars titling, we might have called this podcast episode 4 A New Hope. And we can aptly focus on our new hope, Rodion's Kurucs, who, after taking a DNP CD in the first game back from the All-Star break against Portland, has resumed his minutes, both in two Nets victories. And, you know, just wanted to talk a little bit about him and the four position in general. And I think that, like, when, you know, when we talk about that position and obviously looking at the success that the Nets had going into the All-Star break, I think one of the biggest kind of X factors and biggest kind of out of nowhere additions that they had during that time was Rodion's play, both in terms of, you know, his ability to have offensive gravity stretching the floor, his ability to cut and kind of, I think as Zach Lowe put it, just skulk back door and find himself in position for layups. His ability to use his freakishly long frame to be disruptive on the defensive end, his ability to guard multiple positions. But I think we saw kind of as that win streak ended, you know, part of the reason was because his play was trailing off. I mean, I wanted to ask you, you know, what have you seen change in his game before that? If you feel like it's changed since the All-Star break, we can talk about that too. And you know, how important do you feel like he is to these Nets down the stretch?
Carl, before we get into that, I'm a little bit rattled. I feel like I'm now going to get skewered by hardcore Star Wars fans across the internet for naming Episode 4 Attack of the Zones. I am not a Star Wars noob either. That was a tough one. I don't know if our podcast will ever recover.
Well, I'm still bummed that we didn't trade. Well, I didn't want to trade for Dennis Schroeder for basketball reasons, but for podcast reasons, I did wish that we had traded for him so that we could have named Episode 1 The Phantom Dennis.
That would have saved us, Carl.
It would have.
Oh, that was a tough one. I'm really glad you brought up Kuroks skulking, so to speak. That was one of my favorite parts of his game to watch because it showed a cerebral intelligence and almost natural reaction to the game that you don't see from a lot of young players. The fact that he just seemed to always be open. You'd look on the court, D'Lo, somebody else would flip a one-handed pass and all of a sudden Kuroks would be standing right next to the hoop and lay the ball in. That was something that I hadn't seen for a long, long time since the Jason Kidd era with the Nets, wide open layups from one-handed passes on our power forward and center position. Unfortunately, I really think that the rest of the league, now that they have film on Kuroks and we're starting to see, and he in particular is starting to see some of these teams for the second time, understands that that's a major part of his game and how he scores and has game planned for it. And I think that we've seen a bigger dip, in fact, a big dip in the number of cuts and passes and easy layups and easy buckets that he's getting from those cuts because teams are now prepared for it. So that's one of the changes that I've seen. It's not like he's not trying to do that. I just think that teams are better prepared for A, him being a threat, and B, him being a threat to cut and try to find holes and open spots specifically instead of just stand in the corner and be a floor spacer like a lot of the other power forwards in the league.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think that there's definitely some adjustment that's going on. I think it's I don't really have any numbers to back this up, but just anecdotally, I feel like teams aren't just sort of hiding their defensive liability on him because, you know, I feel like that was a little bit what was happening earlier in the season. And I think he was also taking teams by surprise just with his kind of motor and his energy out there in terms of just being somebody that, you know, maybe they didn't think that, you know, maybe they thought they could kind of spell a more offensive minded player in terms of, you know, guarding, you know, by putting them on him and, you know, he's able just by being so active to kind of shed that. So I do feel like that's part of it. I also, you know, there was an interesting quote from Kenny Atkinson there was a good profile on Rodion's in The Athletic that Michael Scotto did that came out right after the All-Star break on February 19th, where Kenny said, you know, I think he's hitting the wall a little bit, which is to be expected. For us to keep moving up, we need him to get back to being Rhodey. It's not just his shooting. It's his steals, the rebounds, his energy, and his activity. We've got to help him out, too. It's on us a little bit. I think what happens in this league, they get to know your game real quick, and he's going to have to adjust a little, and we're going to have to adjust a little when we're putting him out there in different lineups and figuring things out. I think we need to do a better job. So I thought that was an interesting quote, particularly the way that Kenny was talking about kind of putting him in different positions and putting him in different rotations. I know that that's something that has been a real kind of area of concern of a lot of Nets fans since the All-Star break, and particularly like when you look at the role that Rondé has been playing, who has just taken two DNPs really for the first time, I think, since being healthy all year. And Jared Dudley, who's also taken a couple DNPs back to back.
I agree with that. And I love that you talked about the Kenny article and his quote about taking responsibility for helping Rodions adjust. And again, this is anecdotal. I wish I had some specific things to bring up, but I remember other players finding themselves in this position at a young age and coaches saying things like, well, he's just going to have to learn to adjust to the league now that teams have found out, and not necessarily taking that on themselves to say, okay, we need to sit down with our player and put them in a better position to be successful on the court and maintain their confidence. Because losing confidence at a young age when you haven't proven to yourself that you can fight through and grit through the bad times and come out on the other side could potentially derail a career permanently. And this is a very, very delicate time in any player's development. I don't feel like I don't feel like anybody is better qualified than Kenny Atkinson to do that, having gone through this before with so many young players, not even with the Nets, but most specifically with the Nets. That's where coaching staffs can really be helpful, because they've seen this, they've gone through it with other players, whereas this player has never gone through this before. Every young player has never gone through this before, and they need somebody to say, hey, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. This is normal. You're not playing poorly. You don't suck. We just now have to make adjustments. Here's some of the specific things that you can make.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of my favorite things, I think, about watching this team. And we compare, we kind of compare the Markinson sort of program, if you will, to the San Antonio Spurs a lot. And that's always something that I thought the Spurs did really well, was like really sort of purposefully and actively trying to put guys in positions to succeed and to learn and to develop, and not just sort of roll the balls out and let him go play. So that's something that's exciting. You know, one specific thing that he called out there was the rebounding, particularly in terms of his kind of effort and energy. And I looked up some stats after. So after the Blazers game, after watching kind of Enes Kanter drink our milkshake like he so often does so many times, you know, I was really kind of fascinated by the rotation at the four, and specifically about the rebounding, because like I just felt like in that game we got just totally and completely punked on the glass. I don't remember off the top of my head what the offensive rebound possession of the Blazers was, but it was something obscene. It was actually, I have it right here. The Blazers got 53%. They had an offensive rebounding percentage of 53%, which is absolutely insane. Meaning they rebound half of their own misses, which is crazy.
That's rough too.
Yeah, exactly. And Davis was playing, and you know, Jared Allen, I think, you know, rebounding is probably not the most shining, you know, part of his game. And I think, you know, the other thing is the way that the rotation at the four has kind of worked, whether you're talking about Rhodey, you're talking about Rondé, Trevion Graham, Jared Dudley, you know, none of those guys really seem like super natural rebounders. I mean, it's not like we're throwing Reggie Evans out there. It sort of just generally seems like the plan for rebounding is transition offense is going to scare the other team away, and we're just going to be long enough to just grab as many balls as we can. But you know, there's some pretty significant differences there in terms of height and length between like a 6'5" Trevion Graham, who seems like obscenely undersized at the four, and somebody like Rhodey, who's 6'9", or Rondé, who's got, you know, a huge wingspan. So I was just looking at the rebounding numbers and kind of the on-off splits of each of these guys, and this obviously is an isolating time that they're playing at the four, you know, because they could have shared the floor one moment or another. But I did notice that Rhodey had by far the best rebound splits of everybody on missed field goals. You know, they're 6 percentage points better with Rhodey on the floor than they are with him off. He's higher across the board than just about everybody. Rondé is plus +7 on missed free throws, which I think is because he does play a lot of offense defense stuff. So he gets a lot of those end of game free throws when the rebounds aren't necessarily contested. Travion Graham is kind of an absurd plus +10 on missed threes, which I guess is, you know, speaks well to his hustle. And unfortunately, Jared Dudley is down pretty significantly across the board in all metrics. But I thought that was interesting. You know, particularly when I think some of the reasoning for not playing him is size related, that they do rebound better with Rodie on the floor.
That, I mean, that is good to know, but and it's tough to imagine them rebounding better with him off the floor, considering the alternatives that we have on the team. And I was looking up some of the things that may have changed and were indicative of the hustle factor not being there due to quote unquote hitting the, once again, anecdotal rookie wall. And while rebounding was one of the things that I was taking a look at, that is, I think offensive rebounding is the thing in particular that's been indicative of his drop, because from October, November, December, January, he was averaging right around one offensive rebound a game. That's dropped to less than half an offensive rebound a game in February. And if you look at some of the other hustle stats, let's say steals, blocks, some of those defensive stats, his steals have dropped in half from just under one to about just under a half. And his blocks have remained the same. So it's really those deflections, the fighting for those offensive rebounds, the movement that I think either teams have wisened up for, or he's starting to get a little bit tired, because you and I and every Nets fan that is super nerdy about this stuff read the articles about him not playing in Europe or playing 4 minutes a game because his coach was angry that he wanted to go to the NBA and was an NBA prospect. He's never played this type of load before, and this is him playing himself into shape and understanding the type of fitness that he needs to keep his body in to get through an 82 game season. So he, I would say, is less prepared to get through an 82 game season than anybody the Nets have drafted in the past, or potentially anybody else in the rookie class outside of injuries.
You suggesting that, you know, spending the year on the Barcelona B team and not actually playing there is not the best way to get your conditioning up?
Chain smoking with the Barcelona B team?
Yeah, I agree with all that. I mean, but, you know, I'm hoping, and I think, you know, from watching him over just, you know, obviously a small sample, but the last two games, like, I think, you know, when I looked at possible trades before the trade deadline, and when we've talked about, you know, possible buyout guys, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second, you know, this position on the Nets right now is in a state where you don't really need to be great. You know, we're not talking about needing to come in and play at an all-star level. I mean, I think a replacement level player would be a pretty significant upgrade right now. I mean, I was kind of jokingly saying, you know, we should measure guys on either Vork, which was value over Rodion Skoruks, or God forbid Voron, which is value over Rondé, or my personal favorite, and I think probably the most reasonable, which is Vadage, which is value over Travion Graham. So, you know, you're not asking. So I think like when we talk about that in the context of Rodi, like what we need from him down the stretch isn't for him even to necessarily return to the form that he was pre All-Star break. We just need him to kind of tread water and stay on the floor. And we can kind of, Kenny can kind of adjust the minutes, whether it's playing a little bit more of Damari Carroll at the four or, you know, flexing with you know, Travion Graham, I think is like a perfect sort of replacement level guy to just kind of patch the boat and continue to float.
You're right.
Is that sort of how you feel about it, or
That is how I feel about it. It's funny because this position has given us so little this year that getting any sort of production about it out of the four spot really, really affects the outcome of our games. If you look at the plus minus of Rodians and our wins versus our losses, in wins he's a 2.4 and in losses is a negative 4.6. So it really, really drops off in the Nets record really, really drops off in games that he doesn't play well. And that's after sporting an overall negative 0.4 plus minus for the season. So it's not like he's positive all the time. And those losses are the things dragging down his net rating. Now, I will say that I wholeheartedly agree with not necessarily upgrading the four spot via trade. Given what was out there, I just really feel like we would have mortgaged a little bit too much of the future considering the price for some of those assets like Mirotić or Tobias Harris or some of the other players that were traded. I think it was a little bit too rich for us, even though I did like the package that Marks was potentially or allegedly offering for Jamichael Green, who I think would have been a nice two-way player for this team down the stretch. I think that standing pat at the deadline itself and upgrading that position via trade this season, given the market for fours, would have been a short-term fool's errand for the Nets.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that, you know, that's also one of the things just heading into the off season that gives me some optimism is that, you know, you don't need to sign Kevin Durant to markedly improve this team. Obviously he would be an amazing fit and that would rise us to, you know, one of the top teams in the East. But I think there's plenty of sort of stopgap solutions that, you know, you can find to just really buoy the four and maximize that value that you have with other guys on the team. But with that said, you know, agree with you on not making the trade at the deadline. I do sort of wonder, you know, with the March 1st deadline for buyouts coming up pretty soon, the next couple days, is it worth looking at anybody for that position? And, you know, looking at what may or may not be available, not a lot out there. I think the name that's come up the most is Frank Kaminsky, who is not actually available from Charlotte, but, you know, should he be released? I think Zach Randolph is out there. Omri Caspi. I jokingly looked at Trevor Booker. And then I was, you know, trying to think of a couple outside the box candidates. So I was looking at the Chinese league. So Donatas Montiunas could be from the Shandong Golden Stars, you know, could be an option.
Yes, or, Shandong.
Brett, what if the Nets were like a surgeon, sturgeon, cutting for the very second time a check to Andrew Nicholson from the Fujian Sturgeons, who is shooting 45% from three on six attempts a game. You know, he previously shot 36% for Orlando in 2015. You know, so maybe that's worth exploring. 45% is better than Jimmer.
Go Fujian or Shandong, Carl.
It's Fujian, the Fujian Sturgeons. I looked up the pronunciation and then I just completely barked it. Fujian. Fujian.
Oh wow! It's giving me PTSD to talk about some of the contracts that we took on with Andrew Nicholson, or some of the offers that were potentially made to DeMontis Montiunas. I will say that what we do with the buyout market will be very indicative of the future of Rondae Hollis-Jefferson and this Nets team. I am going to hold firm on my statement that I really think no other teams are going to offer him a contract. And if they do, it's going to be so low that the Nets might consider matching it just because he's such a great culture guy and cares so much about the people on this team and hustles so much when he's out on the floor. But if we pick out somebody on the buyout market and his minutes drop, I think it's a very, very clear indication that he's not in the long-term plan of the Nets, and that we're not going to re-sign him going into next year. So while I don't know if we're A, if we're going to look at a buyout candidate, and B, where that's going to come from, I think if we do, and if we do sign somebody and drop RHG's minutes a ton, that means that no way, shape, or form is he going to be back with this team.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think just the reality of it being the 26th of February and there being 2 days left in the buyout market, I'm not particularly optimistic that we're going to pick anybody up, but I did really want to say DeMontis Montiennis. So I'm glad we did that segment anyway.
I'd love Frank the Tank.
Had it in the notes since last week. I know I would love him too, but I don't think that Jordan's going to let him go because MJ loves him. And Michael Jordan loves Frank Kaminsky as much as he loves JNCO style pants.
As much as he loves early 2000 style. Or the
exactly
the naughties, as I heard them called. I really like that
the naughty oddies. Yeah, and I think with Rondé, I think Rondé is a mess right now, and in the Portland game, in addition to I think just the challenges that he has with fitting in offensively and things like that, he was pressing like crazy
on several occasions.
Where he'll take the ball and just run a break that, should be like a 3-on-2 and turn it into a 1-on-2, without even trying to get anybody else involved. And so, I think I think he's in his own head a little bit this year. We've seen a couple times where, he's really gone overboard on calls or just really expressing lots of frustration. Earlier this year, he got teed up and almost got into a fight with Jared Allen. I do tentatively hope and sort of pencil him in for a bit of a bounce back year next year. I also feel like he probably has more value to the Nets than he would anywhere else, just because he's familiar with the system and because he's got kind of two things that he brings to the basketball team right now. One is his ability as a defender. And I still think he's probably the best individual defender on this team. So that's worth something. And the positional flexibility that unlocks his defensive potential is also there. And then I think also he has some just the flexibility in general to allow him to be kind of like a utility infielder type player. I think right now he's with no disrespect to Alan Williams, he's probably our third string five. He's probably our third string four or fourth string four. He's somebody who I think we'll see him play down the stretch, on some of these back-to-back nights and, coming in when guys are hurt, but really sort of as a minute sponge and somebody that can kind of soak up time at a bunch of different positions.
And I don't know why at this point we don't throw him in at the five spot way more often. I think you made a really good point when we were texting the other day where you said you view Rondé Hollis-Jefferson as more of a akin to a baseball utility player at this point, where if you're at the end of the game and you need quick offense, defense, substitutions, and you're able to do that because then you can use your timeouts knowing that the game's going to end. And if you still have timeouts, they're worthless at that point. That's where he really does provide value, because he can switch across all four positions or all five positions theoretically. And he does have very, very smart defensive instincts. He's not just out there going full bore on defense like somebody like a Marquise Chris and making terrible decisions. He's out there making smart passes, and he really, really, really gets off on getting a hand in somebody's face and knowing that he affected a shot. You can tell that he really loves it. And again, this is anecdotal. There's nothing to back that up, but somebody that really, really likes playing defense and views that as an essential part of their game, that's a rare player to find nowadays, because that's not what gets you paid.
Yeah, no, I think that's, I think it's a really good point. I personally feel he's been much more effective on the offensive end in previous seasons. So I don't think he's somebody that's never going to be able to put it together. I think we've all been sort of sitting around waiting for him to develop a corner three, and maybe that's not going to happen. But that doesn't mean that there's no salvageable, offensive game in him at all. I think he does some other things that can be helpful. So I don't really know what that means for us down the stretch or what his future is in the league. But, I think in terms of whether or not we would pull somebody off the sidewalk to take his, you know, spot on the roster. I don't think that that's going to happen right now.
And I'm secretly still holding out hope that the Nets make the playoffs, and when it turns into a slogfest, hopefully against a team like the Indiana Pacers, if the seeding works out correctly, I really think Rondé could have some big moments in a playoff series and potentially swing the momentum of a few games with his hustle, regardless of whether he's throwing 105-mile-per-hour layups off the top of the backboard in transition.
Yeah, that's very fair. We should can we just sub on the fly where he just checks out like in the middle of an offensive possession,
midair,
just go 4-on-5.
Just a bit outside.
Speaking of Rondé's defense and his length and his ability to play small ball five, I think the other thing that we've noticed as a defensive trend, I think because they don't have a lot of guys like Rondé who are that type of lockdown defenders, we've seen the Nets playing a ton of zone defense. It's worked out a lot of the times. It's been an effective changeup. It's gotten a lot of pub around kind of the NBA intelligentsia of people kind of calling it out as a good way to stall some of the better offenses in the league. It's also gotten called out as a negative. I mean, I think like, When the game against Toronto right before the All-Star break, when Kawhi Leonard hit the bank shot game winner, that was against the zone. And it ended up, with Kawhi one-on-one with Jared Allen. And there's an interesting discussion on the Ringer NBA show with Kevin O'Connor and Chris Vernon talking about that, where Kevin O'Connor made the salient point, I think, that like, hey, if you told the Nets at the beginning of the possession that, playing zone was going to get them a fadeaway jumper by Kawhi Leonard with Jared Allen's hand in his face, they'd probably take that 10 times out of 10. The fact that it went in sort of notwithstanding. But I think there was another good example of like the three-pointer that Danny Green hit to tie that game a couple possessions earlier, also came against the zone and was wide open. So I thought, I wanted to talk a little bit about sort of what you've seen from that zone defense, how you've seen it be effective, any kind of concerns you have or sort of what your thoughts are on it in general are.
I'm really glad that you used the example of the end of that Toronto game because it's indicative of both the great strengths and weaknesses of using the zone. Because I do agree that Kawhi Leonard shot means that the zone defense worked perfectly. We got a non-3, really, really tough shot that just happened to go in. And then the Danny Green shot represents the worst part of the zone where if you play in zone defense, what's the number one thing that you're giving up? It's the three-pointer or long shots, which seems counterintuitive in a league that's all about either A, finding layups, or B, finding open three-pointers. It really worked against us on that position. You got one of the best shooters in the league that's been in more big moments than probably 96% of the league wide open. And of course, he ended up knocking that down. Zone is it's such an interesting thing to me because when you read about it and read about its use, it's almost shunned at a professional level and only looked at as a viable option when you're talking about middle school, high school, and college basketball, mainly because it helps you with two things. One, if your players are less athletic than the other team, it allows you to keep up with them without having to ask your five players to keep up with their five players when four of them might be slower.
That is why my fraternity ran zone in intramural league in college.
That is why every basketball team that I've ever been a part of has played zone. I don't even know if I can play man anymore. I don't know how to do it. Ugh. And then two, at those levels, players typically aren't great shooters, so giving up the three-pointer isn't that big of a deal. Whereas in the NBA, if you've made it as a player, you 98% of the time can knock down an open three. So that's why it's been a bit shunned in the NBA. And I have to say that I like anything that changes the game up a little bit. And I think from reading some of the articles about the Nets playing zone and how they've seen teams react to making that change makes me think that doing it in select moments, and I don't care if it's the end of games, it could be in the middle of games if we need a momentum shift, may help because what it does is make the other team think a little bit more which could take them out of an offensive flow. Now, maybe we want to rethink using it at the end of games, but during the middle of a game, if you switch to zone, the other team has seen that because they've played AAU ball, they've played college ball. Almost every team plays some sort of zone. They go into, okay, I know how to attack a zone. I'm going to pass a ton, fly the ball around the perimeter, and get some open shots. Now, that isn't typically part of an NBA-style offense, and thinking instead of just reacting to the game could take a team out of their flow and potentially swing the game back in the Nets' favor, which I'm a huge fan of. Anything that makes the team think a little bit more, make their reaction time a little bit slower, and takes them out of the normal flow of their offense, I think can and has been a positive for the Nets at times. But using it in spot situations at the end of a game when teams are typically either running isolation plays, where you could have somebody like Kawhi Leonard matched up against somebody on the Nets, which wouldn't be an unfavorable, which would be an unfavorable matchup for us pretty easily with nothing, with no counter to that, or leaving the three-point shooter wide open is tough. So I'd say I'm really excited about it for the majority of the game, and am still the jury's still out on using it at the end of the game.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. Like, I think that, you know, we saw the Nets kind of initially adopted as kind of this change up where, you know, like you said, like when, you know, game is going sort of one way or the other, and you're just trying to kind of jolt the offense in for five or six possessions a game of sort of not knowing what's going on, discombobulating them a little bit. I think like there's the Kevin O'Connor article from The Ringer from last season where they talked about the Nets doing that against the Rockets, and that's like a perfect example. You know, it works in that sort of change of capacity. I think what I've been surprised by is how often the Nets have gone to it this year. You know, just given that, you know, I think there's games where they've played more zone than not zone, or they've gone to zone after sort of every make. But I think, you know, unpacking it a little bit more too, it really, you know, I think one of the things we've seen from Kenny Atkinson on the offensive side of the ball is really trying to put a system together that accentuates player strengths while sort of minimizing weaknesses. And I think if you look at the personnel that the Nets have on this team, you know, one of the weaknesses is containing dribble penetration or on ball defense from the guard position. And I don't think that that's something that either really D'Angelo Russell or Spencer Dinwiddie are particularly good at. So zone kind of mitigates that somewhat. It keeps Jared Allen in the middle and allows him to be a shot blocker so that, you know, even if dribble penetration is kind of getting past you, you still have that last line of defense there. It maximizes his value. And I think it's also like when you look at the just construction of the lineup in terms of the people that are there, the Nets are extremely long, you know, kind of across the board. And so it really sort of allows, you know, activity, length, and active hands to kind of play a bigger role in disrupting the offense in a way that I think, you know, has been fairly effective. I mean, it's not exactly like they're blowing anybody's doors off in man-to-man anyway. So I think zone has kind of become a little bit of a crutch, honestly, to allow them to kind of put themselves in good positions. I think the other thing, last thing that I'll say is, like you mentioned, you know, teams know kind of how to pick apart a zone. And I think that there's a pretty clear formula for how to do that. But you got to kind of play inside out, and it kind of entices, you know, teams to come in and it's a little bit easier to, particularly if you're kind of conceding the mid range, to kind of entice teams to collapse past that first layer of the zone and then kind of give them an open look and have them put it up, which I think they view as sort of analytically a positive outcome.
I have so many thoughts on that. You're right. Playing it more this season takes away the surprise element. And that was my original thought, that we started implementing zone and teaching zone to the players to use it in spot situations as a surprise element to swing the momentum of games or to potentially cause a bad offensive possession for the other team at the end of a game. But the more that I think about it and the more that I think about why we're using it more, that allows teams to prepare for it. Teams are going and facing the Nets like they would face the Mavericks, knowing that Carlisle is potentially going to use zone on over 50% of his possessions. They prepare for that. And the Nets are going to turn into one of those teams if they haven't already. I think that some of the things you pointed out about D'Angelo Russell, and I think even more specifically Joe Harris, playing zone allows the Nets to keep our best offensive players on the floor, or at least our most important offensive players on the floor, for larger stretches of the game. Because I think if we were playing man-to-man defense, I've pointed out the absurd tininess of D'Angelo Russell's calves in the past. It's very, very tough for him and Joe Harris. You can see that they struggle one-on-one. But if you play a zone, they're both incredibly smart, intuitive players. They can stay on the floor and hold their own. And I think there might be more players on the Nets like that, like somebody like an Allen Crabbe who tries really hard on defense but isn't necessarily a great one-on-one defender. Players that are smart and try really hard tend to excel and thrive in a zone. And maybe that allows us to keep players that Kenny wants to keep out on the floor on the offensive end on the floor for longer by playing zone for a longer amount of time during the game.
Yeah, I think that totally makes sense. I mean, I think D'Angelo is really actually the perfect example of this, where this season I've actually been rather impressed by his defense. He's pretty pesky as a defender. He's just never going to be the type of guy that can kind of lock you down, and he's never going to be the type of guy that, you know, is going to contain, you know, a primary pick and roll initiator. And so I think offering this as a change up and allowing guys to like you said, you know, be active and jump passing lanes, and even if they're not getting deflections or getting steals, you know, just bending the offense around it, I think is, you know, they feel is a little bit more effective. And I think it's also worth pointing out, too, that like there's been a lot of different flavors of zone that we've seen them run out there. I mean, for the change up effect, you know, I remember there was a game against Charlotte earlier this year in Barclays Center where you know, the Nets won and threw a box and one at Kemba Walker, you know, when he had the opportunity to take a game winning shot, and that was something that was really effective. We've seen them run, you know, 2-on-2, we've seen them run 2-3, we've seen them run sort of a, you know, a couple different variations of it with you know, more of a matchup you know, type element as well.
Yeah, I really wish that, you know, we were able to look up what percentage of the time the Nets played zone and what players were out on the court when that happened, because that would really allow us to dissect, okay, which players do Kenny and the staff really trust in a man-to-man defense and which ones did they not? Because that would be really indicative of who they truly feel are the Nets' best defenders and who they aren't. That would be really, really interesting to then hold that up to some of the more advanced defensive metrics and see how those things hold up. So we scored every site out there, paid for sites, free sites, to see if we could find this data. We weren't able to, but that would certainly be fascinating. So if anybody knows of a place to look that up, I would love to do a deep dive into that. And I know that Carl and I would enjoy doing a little bit more of that, but I think that we've both learned that nothing on this team happens without a clear purpose and intent behind it that is not only communicated to upper management, but communicated down to the players as well, and saying, hey, you're going to play X percentage of minutes in tonight's game, or no minutes, or this many minutes, more minutes than usual because of this reason. You fit well into this defense. You're a good matchup for this person, et cetera, et cetera. And I would love to know a little bit more behind why we do that. And my guess and my take on it is it allows us to play the players that we want to play on offense longer, because that's what this team values.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one last thing, and this kind of ties a couple things together, but, you know, I think to your point, it allows us to play the players we want to on offense. And I think it also, like, you know, just looking at the makeup of this team, right? Like, there's you have a lot of those hustle guys, a lot of those energy guys. You have a lot of those guys who, you know, are willing to be active. And I thought it was really telling when we were looking for those stats, which we couldn't find. I did find a quote or a note saying that, you know, Kenny Atkinson talking about how based on their internal numbers of zone versus non-zone, that the Nets actually rebound better out of a zone, which is completely counterintuitive to what you would think, but does sort of make sense with this team that frankly doesn't rebound very well in general, doesn't really have any good sort of box out guys and sort of rebounds and frankly defends sort of just through length, activity, hustle, getting 50-50 balls, bringing that type of energy. I thought that was interesting and made sense and kind of reinforced, I think, a lot of what we've talked about.
I'd love to know your thoughts on this. So you still have to help and close out, and there's an intelligent nature to playing an effective zone. On the flip side of that, it is a little bit less intense athletically. And I'm thinking that we might even play more zone down the stretch of the season, knowing that the Nets aren't an amazing defensive team regardless. And that's why we have guys like Ed Davis gobbling up offensive rebounds and slowing down transition opportunities, and a guy like Jared Allen to protect the rim, knowing that folks are probably going to get by our perimeter defenders. I think that playing more zone down this stretch, more than we've already been playing, might help preserve the Nets' stamina, fingers crossed, heading into the playoffs, or at least allow us to survive some of these back-to-backs and one day of rest games going down the stretch.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense, and I think it kind of ties in with their sort of overall load management strategy of, fewer guys and more, interchangeable positions and things like that.
Yeah, and if the Nets are able to preserve their players a little bit and execute it a little bit of a lower at a lower pace, that would be that might get us a few more wins, and both of our predictions of 39 wins down the stretch might be wrong.
Yeah, maybe. Although I think the Nets have well, I don't know. Actually, I don't know. I guess playing at a slower pace, given the kind of high variance team that they are, could. It's kind of an interesting sort of conservative gambit of, maybe conceding a few games that are winnable, but also winning a couple that you might not otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, it's a small sample size, but I think we're 20th in pace since the All-Star break, and we're 2-1. And that's, that's indicative of playing teams that are all in the bottom half of the league in pace. But knowing that the Nets try to push the pace and try to play their percentages and get more possessions, knowing that they have the right type of players to win on offense if we get more possessions, I think that could be a very good sign. And maybe that's just a small sample size, but I'm just looking for silver linings at this point. It's just nice to be hopeful.
Well, hey, we'll take it. We'll take what we got.
Nice.
All right, man. So I think that should just about wrap things up. For those of you who have listened, hope you like the new slim down 2-episode format this week. Please definitely hit us up at nets_pulse@gmail.com if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, or hit us up on Twitter.
This is the new Skinny Girl Nets Pulse podcast, less filling and more taste.
Yeah, someday let me tell you about how I invented a Skinny Girl margarita after it had already been invented, but I arrived at it independently.
I would love you to tell me that story right now. I know that we wrapped up the podcast, but this is the type of stuff I think people hang on to the end of podcasts for.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was like, it would be a cool drink, tequila and seltzer water. And we'll squeeze a lime. And my wife said, that's a Skinny Girl margarita. And I said, not when I'm drinking it, it's not. It's a man's drink.
Well, I just invented it. Shut up. Damn. Well, as usual, we were not ahead of the times.
No, behind the times and overtime as well. But only by 10 minutes this time, which... used to be the time we were trying to hit, so it works out.
Yeah, I think they said 30 to 40 minutes. I'll go with that.
Cool.
Nice, man. Well, always good talking to you. I'll see you next time.
Hey, go Nets.